Okay. I'd like to ask everyone to please take your seats. Remind everyone to either turn off or silence your cell phones or all electronic devices. And with that said, the Children, Family, Seniors Committee will now come to order. And I'd like to remind everyone to turn your microphones on when you respond to the roll, so we'll get that on the record. So Cheryl, you may call the roll.
Chair Altman.
Here.
Representative Zalupas.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Barrera.
Here.
Fratana.
Here.
DeSegli.
Here.
Duggan.
Here.
Fisher is excused. Joseph.
Here.
Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Roach.
Present.
Robinson.
Here.
Roth.
Here.
Sabatini is excused. Trabulsi.
Here.
Valdez.
Present.
Williams.
Here.
Woodson. A quorum is present.
Fantastic. So again, welcome to the committee. I'm excited about our guest here that will be speaking to us. It'll be very relevant to our goals this session. And we have with us to continue our conversation on those issues that we began last week. We have with us Donnie Reed, CEO of Twin Oaks Juvenile Development. And I understand, Donnie, you have some co-presenters, and I'd like to approach the well and introduce your guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and respectfully, it's Red.
Oh, I'm sorry, Red.
The color,
okay.
Red is spelled like Reed,
yeah,
and pronounced,
yeah.
Red.
Okay.
But that's happened our entire life. So
the wonders of the English language.
That's right. I have with me today Mr. Maurice Lewis. He actually graduated yesterday.
Oh, congratulations.
He'll be starting college tonight at 7 o'clock, his first class. Aww. And then Tony Redd, yes, he's a brother, joined us about 10 or 12 years ago, and he's our 16 now. Wow. Yeah, retired out of the Navy and came to work for us, and he wanted to work with kids, and I said, come on. But anyway, he's our director of community programming now. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to meet with you and the invitation. Thank you, committee members and staff. This is anytime we get to talk about Twin Oaks is a great day for us, because we think we do really good work. I'm a former high school chemistry, physics, biology teacher. Was a principal for 10 years. Got frustrated dealing with the kids. At a small middle school, you have to handle everything as a principal, so I had to handle discipline. Got really frustrated with kids that I would work with during the day, and they'd go home to families and go to the streets, broken families go to the streets. In our case, in Liberty County, it's the woods, the Apalachicola National Forest. And then come back just totally undone, and you'd start over again. And I felt led through some circumstances that happened in my life to leave the school district and start dealing with kids on a 24-hour-a-day basis where I could really impact. And as a result of that, we started Twin Oaks Juvenile Development in 1998 down in the middle of the Apalachicola National Forest. I was telling some ladies earlier, when I moved down there for the first 6 months, there were no kids, no staff, and the subsequent 2.5 years, my nearest neighbor was 19 miles away. When you left town, you better have your milk and your bread and whatever else, because you didn't want to drive back. But we are an accredited, CARF accredited agency, and our educational programs are accredited by Advanced Ed. We started our first wilderness program, as I said, in 1998. And with 30 youth and 30 staff, and over the past 23 years, we've grown to now serve 175 residential youth a day and over 1,500 youth per day in community-based programs. And I can safely say that one of our programs touches everybody in this room. So if anywhere you're at in the state of Florida, we're going to have services there. Our programs consist of our residential programs, Liberty Just, which used to be Liberty Wilderness, but we had to change the name, is a boys' mental health and vocational program located in the Apalachicola National Forest. Dove, Developing Opportunities Through Vocational Education, is a girls' program located in Graceville, Florida. Apalachicola Forest Youth Camp is the state's only residential competency restoration program. It's also located in the Apalachicola National Forest. And Waypoint, which is a residential group home for difficult-to-place foster kids throughout the state of Florida. And then we have our DOT Youth Work Experience Program, which you will hear about later. Our community programs are Project Connect, which is a transition program that serves youth leaving facilities throughout the state of Florida and re-entering their communities in North Florida. So anything from Ocala, north to Jacksonville, and over to Pensacola, kids coming out of residential program, we surround them with mentors and provide them with services, and Tony's going to speak to that in just a minute. We also have Twin Oaks Forensic Outpatient Services. It's a statewide program, and it's the state's community competency restoration program. If we can deal with the kid in the community and keep them from having to come to a residential program, we'd rather do that. And so we provide those services in the community, at schools, at libraries, at churches, at Boys and Girls Clubs, at homes, in the home when possible. TOX, our Twin Oaks Community Services, a case management service in Circuit 14 for in-home and out-of-home foster children. So we run the gamut of DJJ programs, DCF programs, residential, and community-based. We also have, and this is something we're very proud of, Boys and Girls Club of Tabula Rasa. Twin Oaks operates a Boys and Girls Club unit in each of our residential programs. What we're really proud of is we're the only Boys and Girls Club chartered in the country, chartered specifically to our charter is for us to be in DJJ and DCF residential programs. That was a huge accomplishment for us, because when a youth leaves our residential programs and goes home, those people back at the Boys and Girls Club, they know those kids. They've known them from their community for years. They can refuse membership, but they cannot refuse a transfer of membership. And so they leave as a card-carrying member of our Boys and Girls Club, and they go back and they transfer into their Boys and Girls Club back in their community. You know, that's really big. But we also, as in a way to give back, because it's so expensive and so difficult to do Boys and Girls Clubs, even in large communities, you know all the fundraising you see going on in your community in Boys and Girls Club. We provide Boys and Girls Club services in 8 communities, rural communities, that would never be able to afford Boys and Girls Club services. Bristol, Bluntstown, Madison, Greenville. Those are just some of the communities that we offer those services to, and that's hugely successful. All of our programs have been highly successful, as demonstrated by the success of our youth, historically lower recidivism rates, and high scores on our quality assurance reviews, our monitoring reviews, and all of our accreditation reviews. I could stand up here and talk to you about our successes for hours. I could give you an example of a kid that went through our program, got certified in welding, had no place to go. We got him a job in Norfolk, Virginia, and he's now an underwater welder. He's worked his way up through training OJT to be an underwater welder, and probably makes more money than me, you know. Just incredible. I can tell you the story of a kid that was about this tall and about this big when he graduated from our program at 15 years old, but had a certification in carpentry, who now owns his own electric company. He walked up to me at a gas station about 5 years ago. He'd been out of the program for probably 13, 14 years, and I didn't recognize him. He was 6'8", and weighed about 325, and it was a really good 325. He didn't need to be playing offensive line in the NFL is what he needed to be doing. But just, I could tell you story after story of successes that we've had through vocational training, the way we approach residential programming, the way we normalize our kids, put them in the community, make them part of our community. They work in at the Veterans Memorial Railroad. They work festivals. They've become so much a part of the community that when we take them into town, they're no longer looked at as one of Donnie's boys. They're looked at as part of the community. We oftentimes, when we take them to the Appalachian restaurant, the only restaurant in town, by the way, people come up to us and sit down and talk and interact with the boys. So they thank you for doing this. I saw you guys working on this. Thank you. Our girls in Graceville, they're going to be cleaning up, participating in the fall festival tomorrow, and then cleaning up on Saturday as part of community service. And we just integrate kids into the community, and they feel that sense of belonging. A lot of times some of them have never felt that before, and belonging to a community, something bigger than themselves. But I could talk about that for hours. I better stop. I brought a young man today with us, and he's our most recent success story. And he can tell the story way better than I ever could. So I'd like to introduce Maurice Lewis and let him tell him or his story to you. Come on, Maurice.
Good morning. My name is Maurice Lewis. I'm 17 years old from Gainesville, Florida. Before I begin sharing my story, I wanted to tell you a little bit about myself and my background. My mom is in prison. I don't know who my dad is, and my adopted mom died 2 days before I got locked up. I bounced from home to home in different programs my whole life. I guess you could say I was a lost kid. I didn't have anything. I didn't have anyone. Before coming to the program, I was in survival mode. I wanted to drop out. Had no guidance. I had to be independent for most of my life. That is when I started having issues with the law. They could tell you when I first got to the program, I didn't want to be there. I was getting in trouble. I didn't want to go to school, and I did not respect authority. Being a kid with nothing, a kid on the streets, not many people respect you. It's almost like you're nothing. And this bothered me. It bothered me a lot. If I felt like I didn't get enough respect, then I wasn't going to give it. I didn't care if you were the police, the detention staff, the program director, or the teachers. I acted out as much as possible. If I was miserable, I plan on making sure you were miserable too. I remember getting in so much trouble, the director asked me whether I ever wanted to leave. I laughed at him. Leave and go where? I did not believe I could trust anyone at the program. The support I had at Justice would change my life. For the first time, there were people that looked at me and didn't see a nothing that didn't deserve any type of respect. They saw me as a human being. They saw me as a lost kid. At Just, there were people who for the first time in my life made promises and really kept them. I had staff tell me not to stress about the fact that I didn't have someone to send me care packages like the other kids. They told me to trust them, and they made sure I always had what I needed. For the first time, this wasn't a lie. I needed flip-flops. I got Adidas ones the next day. Everything I needed, I got. And they didn't just give me clothes, shoes, and body wash. They provided me the structure and support I needed to change my life. Through the Youth Work Experience Program with DOT, I was even able to pay off my court fees and restitution. Like I said, I never really had guidance or the tools to be successful. Once Just had placed those tools in my hand, I surprised myself because I began to build. When it came time to go home, I began to feel lost again. DCL didn't want to help and couldn't find a place for me, but the education staff did not give up. Then the job course rep we were working with disappeared. I was a lost kid all over again with nowhere to go. But the staff had just told me not to worry, and that they wouldn't let me fall. People like Mr. Simpson, Ms. O'Mill, Mr. Cole, Ms. Boone, and Mr. Davin refused to give up on me. Even when I wanted to give up, they wouldn't. They reminded me about Project Connect, a Twin Oaks program that gives kids like me support after we leave so that we never feel like nobody. They spent days and nights calling every single option they could of until they could find me somewhere to go. Because of how hard they worked, they got me to a special pilot program led by Mr. Travis George, where I will be the first youth to spearhead their second initial first impression program. This is a picture of me and my family. You can see the mom and dad shirts they are wearing to support me. These people never gave up on me. Because I had to go to Twin Oaks Liberty Just, I am proud to say that today will be my first day at Florida Gateway College. My first class is today at 7 p.m. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to open up. You're a hero. Well spoken. You have survived and come through. I'm so impressed. Yes, Representative Woodson.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Sir, thank you so much for not giving up on him.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, young man, I have to say I commend you for turning your life away. We have so many of these young men we have lost because nobody really cares. And for you to stand here and spoke to us like that, it went straight to my heart. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional because I have two kids of my own, and we are all responsible for those children. We need more programs like this to save our young men. We have a lot of programs for young women, but we need more for these young men because they are the one. They need to focus. They need to remain on track. We don't need any more of y'all at the juvenile hall. So thank you, sir. Sorry, Mr. Chair. We need to have more programs in the state to save our young men. So thank you for what you're doing. You need to remain focused. Take what the program has given you and go out there and soar and take some other young men with you. So thank you. You have a friend in the legislature, and I'm one of your friends. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes. Yes, Representative Robinson.
Rep. Woodson said a whole lot, but I just wanted you to know that I truly appreciate both of you. I'm an educator, so when you were talking about education, I truly understood. And it's so many kids, so you are an example, and you're letting everybody else know that you can make it. I also work with a lot of foster kids, and so I do have a question. My question was, do you have to be a part of the juvenile system to actually go through this program, or do you all help kids that may not have gotten in trouble with the law?
Going to hear about another program in just a few minutes.
Okay.
Specifically for foster kids.
Okay. That's. Thank you.
Representative Williams.
I'm over here wiping tears away as I am so full. Young man, thank you for telling your story. Your story brought me to tears, and I see a couple more representatives here wiping with tears also. But my question is to you, if you had the opportunity to speak to young men that is going through the same thing, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say if you put your mind to it, you can do it. You just got to put a dedication into it. You got to put work in it. Like I did, like I said, I didn't want to do it. Me personally, I really didn't want to do school, and they kept pushing me, so something clicked in my head. I was like, well, I need to get this done. So then I switched to GED, got it done. They helped me. They made sure I got my GED done, and that helped me.
Yes, sir. Representative Barman.
I just want to say that I'm truly impressed with you, and thank you so much for sharing your story, and you're a role model youth around the state and the nation. I have a question about the program and what happens, what your next steps are. So what happens, like, are people helping you now that you're aging out? because that's what concerns me is when people age out with college transition, college housing, what kind of support are you getting with all, in all of those areas, and who's going to help mentor you through that process?
Well, the education staff, they're going to be always help me out. Uh-huh. And the people at the college, the program, like I said, the Second Chance First Impression Program, Mr. Travis George, got a good program. He's going to help me out, get me in housing. Uh-huh. College is paid for.
All right, that's good to hear. So is that part of your program, or is that the program you linked him to as a transition into adulthood?
Well, we linked him to those programs as part of his transition, but he'll also be provided support through transition specialists, through Project Connect, which Tony's going to be talking about in a few minutes.
And can I ask you what, Chair? Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Do you know what you want to study and what you want to do?
Well, at Florida Gateway College, I want to get my AA in commercial air conditioning and heating, and then get transferred to FAMU for architecture.
Wow. Thank you. It's very brave of you to come up and share that. Thank you, Chair, for bringing him here.
Fantastic. Okay, you got your question answered. Representative Joseph? And Rep. Valdez. Oh, yours. Okay, good.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's your name again?
Maurice Lewis.
Mr. Lewis.
Yes, ma'am.
You've heard a lot from my colleagues, and I want to speak to you in a little bit of a different direction. You have crossed a pivotal threshold in your life. So if you picture you're going up a hill, instead of going down, you're on the way up, and you can stay up there. But I promise you, not because I want it to come, you're going to have some challenges come later on. And when those come, you're going to be feeling like, can I make it through? Or will I go back to where I was? And it's going to bring up some stuff. When that happens, I want you to remember not just this moment, but all the moments that you've had with these people who are there to affirm that you are important, that you matter, that you are loved. And that ain't got nothing to do with what you do from this point forward. You don't have to do anything else in your life, and you are still valuable. It's not tied to what you do or don't do. You're valuable because you are you. That's one. So even if you mess up a little bit, that's okay. What's important is that you get back up. Second, you will be able to touch other young men and women because you're going to be able to relate to them in a way that nobody else can. And when those opportunities present themselves, I want you to just remember how you felt when somebody did that for you. And I just thank you in advance for what I know you're about to do. Bless you all. Thank you.
One more question. Maurice, you stole the show here. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Altman. Actually, congratulations, son. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
And I know that you're going to do fabulous things, and just the stick-to-itness. And I echo the same comments that my colleagues have made. You do matter. You are somebody, and you will always be somebody. And I'm very proud of you. So now my question to the presenter is, what are your student demographics? Of the percentages of the students that you serve, the children that you serve, what are the demographics?
We're at about 50% Caucasian, 50% African American. Doesn't really change male female. That's historically for the last 23 years. That's about where we land. A great percentage of our kids are ESE kids and require special services. Not all, but a good percentage of them are greater than the public school system.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Altman. What are your biggest challenges in trying to help the youth?
We've overcome that hurdle, and I'll tell you how. The biggest biggest challenge is we pour our lives into these kids, and as evidence what these two ladies have done to get Maurice placed where he's at, I cannot explain how difficult it was. You know, it's typical of a DCF, DJJ kid, that dually served young man, young woman, where they a placement will fall through the day before they're to graduate, or a placement can't be found. You heard his story. It was very similar to that. But through their efforts, they stuck with it, never gave up on him. And you know, we have a difficult time with the crossover kids, dually served. Crossover is an old term. Dually served youth, placing them. You know, let's face it, who wants to foster a kid that's been in a DJJ program and been in multiple home placements? It's just really difficult. That's why Waypoint exists. When I talked about Waypoint,
yes, sir.
And you know, it's interesting how that dynamic has changed over the years. We went from having that program to, you know, one of the things we actually pride ourselves on is being a solutions-oriented company. Every program we've ever started for the last 23 years has been a solution to the to an issue here in the state of Florida for at-risk youth. And whether it be the first girls vocational program, taking the residential competency restoration program where they had them scattered in mental health institutions and pulling them all together into a tranquil location in the middle of the national forest where lights wasn't going everywhere. And, you know, I was on the SAG, the governor's advisory group, for many years. And what really impacted me, we were doing a tour, and it was right off, please, nobody from Orlando take offense to this, but it was right off, the location was right off I-4. And you could see the lights from Disney doing all this, and you could hear the buzz from I-4 going by. I got back to my hotel, and I said, so I drove back over there, and I sat in the parking lot, and I just, Lord, show me what I can do. And 2 years later, we put in a proposal to move all those kids together. They had tremendous numbers of youth-on-youth violence and sexual youth-on-youth sexual offenses. Knock on wood, we've had in 21 years, we've had two youth-on-youth sexual assaults. So, you know, those are issues, but you know, we've solved that through Project Connect. We've solved the issues of, well, let me back up. Our biggest issue, whether it's a foster kid or a kid with a nuclear family intact, is reintegrating them back into the community. We've had them, we've loved on them, we've taught them, we've done everything possible for that youth for 6 months, 9 months. We watch them grow, and then we take them back to the community. And we knew that early on. So we started, what was the name of it back then? I can't even remember the name. Continuous care. I sat in the dugout back in year 99 in Quincy, Florida, talking to a kid out of quitting a job. But we knew we needed to do more. So, you know, we put together a program called Project Connect that follows the youth back into the community. Maurice will have two people with him, assisting him, will follow him back into the end of the community and mentor him, get him set up for services, whatever he needs. And, you know, this is probably a good time for me to, I was going to say, we've got hugely successful programs. We're impacting kids' lives daily and life-changing impact. But Project Connect and transitioning back in the community is probably one of our toughest but our most successful. And I'm going to let Tony talk about that because I just had open heart surgery. I can't talk long. I lose my breath. But that's what I brought him along. But he's the expert in Project Connect. I want him to talk about two things: Project Connect and transitioning these kids home so they can be successful, And you heard Maurice talk about the Youth Work Experience Program, putting dollars in kids' pockets. You heard him say, I don't have any restitution. I don't have any court fees to pay. You know how many kids in the state of Florida stay on probation because they can't pay those court costs and restitution? The first kid we had walked off the bus, got off the van, and I said, you see those cattle gaps? I had to explain what cattle gaps was to him. He was a kid from Miami. I said, when you cross those cattle gaps, I said, I want you to drop that baggage you brought with you. He said, I already brought it with me. I said, I'm not talking about your clothes. I'm not talking about anything else you brought. Back then, they could bring stuff, Maurice. Now you can't bring things. I said, those worries about restitution, those worries about community service, those fears you got of going back home, we're going to take care of all that. And when you walk out of here, don't pick them back up. You don't have to worry about restitution. You don't have to worry about community service. We're going to handle that. You're going to do it. You're going to work, but you're going to get it done, and you're not going to have to face that when you go home. And you heard Maurice say he doesn't have any of that, and that's a huge, huge thing. Those two programs, I want Tony to speak to those while I – thank you. I'm going to rest a minute so I can get back going when he gets through, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Come on, Tony.
Can you imagine how long he could talk with a good heart? I'm the younger brother. I can do that. So, like Donnie said, in 2005, he said, stop playing sailor boy, come get a real job. And so I retired from the Navy and joined Twin Oaks. So I've been very fortunate in my lifetime to be able to serve two wonderful causes, one, the defense of our nation, and two, juvenile justice kids. And when I picked up the mantle for Project Connect, I said, this is a game changer. And it's a game changer because about 20 years ago, they developed the continuous care model while I was still playing sailor boy. And the Blue Ribbon study by then Secretary of Department of Juvenile Justice, Wansley Waters, determined that transition services were the way to go for juvenile justice kids. I believe that we'd done it in a pilot project. So I knew that when this contract came about 8 years ago, now we're a little over 8 years into it, I knew I was the guy for this program because I wanted passionate about it. It's easy to get passionate when this happens, right? Every year I do an annual report, and it's quite lengthy, and it'll put you to sleep if you ever want to read it. But it's a lot of data, and it's like I point out to my staff, every year I count how many people that I serve, how many kids that I serve, and it's always zero. It's people like that. You know, it's people that dedicate their lives that we can't pay them enough, and we can't thank them enough. And the wonderful service that they provide day in and day out is remarkable. So what we do in Project Connect, every youth is going back into the community. They're going back in their home. We know, you know, they're going back in that same socioeconomic problems and issues, the same family issues that they had before they left. But as all of you pointed out, these are people. These are kids. They need a change in paradigm, and they need that service. So we focus on four core principles: education, vocation, transportation, and mentoring. Mentor being huge. I had one component that's not even in our contract that we added with a partnership with River Phoenix Center for Peace Building down in Gainesville, Florida, and that is restorative justice family integration, reintegration circles. Because a lot of times the trauma that's left behind when the kid goes off to a residential program still remains in the home. So when my staff come in to do their work, we got to deal with that trauma from the family standpoint. We got to recognize that trauma. We've got to give it a name, we've got to give it a value, and we've got to deal with it so we can have the family and the youth move forward in their transition plan. It's an integrated, individualized transition plan that focuses on those core areas. And that's been working very well. For about the eighth of a cost of a residential bed, we're able to provide that service. And it's been a highly successful program. Last year, 92% of the youth who, definition by contract for recidivism, 92% of the youth did not recidivate last year. Measured 1 year later, so you're talking about the youth the year before, 86% did not recidivate. Those numbers are really high if you understand the recidivism rate on average in the state of Florida. It works because all youth that enter the system have those four core needs. in some way, some more than others, right? Some more of an educational, because maybe they're younger, so they don't need a vocational as much. But we individualize that plan for every kid so that they can receive those services, so that we have a thorough plan for every one of them to be successful. Job placement is huge. Just last month, we were able to celebrate my employee of the quarter in Jacksonville, Florida, in Circuit 4, Minnie Glover, placed 7 of her 12 youth in her caseload. She placed 7 of them in jobs last month, which was huge, in 4 different industries. So that was that's a hallmark of our program. We placed 312 youth into employment last year, which was 98.8% of youth who had that on their plan as a goal received employment. That's a hallmark of our plan. Mentoring, like I said, is one of the components. Last year, we had 3,455 different individual mentoring events. Over 3,600 mentoring hours were poured into the program. Those are all volunteers that we recruit from the community. Business leaders, churches. Churches are a big part of what we do. So the return on investment of that was, you know, there's a from the Department of Labor, there's a, you know, a independent sector gives a value on the volunteer hours. So it was over $105,000 in return on investment to the state just by the volunteer hours that we were able to do. So highly successful program. It's successful because every youth needs that service. Now I'm going to say one thing about the continuum of services in the department. To me, there's a gap after diversion. So you've got civil citation, you've got diversion programming. Now you've got a kid on probation, and the kid's sitting there on probation with these court fees and restitution that we talked about. And then the next step is going to be residential. They've got wonderful JPOs. The JPOs we work with, top notch. They do their job in supervision, but they can't do these services. The core components of what we do is in partnership with them. They do wonderful work in supporting our program. But those youth, we'll just take Leon County, for example. Here I have 40 slots for youth in Leon County. Probably about 5 to 10 of those slots at most are for regular probation kids, because we do serve regular probation, pre-residential commitment. Majority of our kids, the first priority in the contract is post-commitment. So we're only serving about 5. There are over 200 on probation just here in Leon County. So it gives you a taste of the kids that are on probation. They've got court fees and restitution, and they're not receiving any of those core services that we talked about. So if there is a need in the state of Florida, it's right there on that continuum. It's in the probation. Regular probation, they've passed diversion, they're on probation, they're sitting there because of court fees and restitution, they're not getting these services, and then they're going into resident, you know, violate probation, right? You know, miss curfew, all those kind of things. Would have been me if I was on there. They violate, and now they're on, now they're in a residential program. There's wonderful services for them as far as clinical, but not in the practicum services, what I call the practicum services, those core education, transportation, mentoring, and vocational. Those services are not being provided. To me, that's a part of the continuum that we need to shore up. And the data that tells us that this works is in this program and in the transition programs in Central and South as well. We're in the North Region contract. The other program, that's Project Connect. Again, that's 1/8 the cost of a residential bed. We all know that, right? Prevention is much better than incarceration cost-wise. The other program that Donnie talked about that I want to mention is Youth Work Experience Program. It's a contract with the Department of Transportation. The funding comes through the Department of Transportation. Highly successful program. We've been doing this for 20 years. It needs expansion because I have other circuits that are asking, how do I get that? I get calls all the time. How do I get that in my area? How do I get in, you know, and that's, of course, a matter of funding from the Department of Transportation. But that program allows for a job training program that pays the youth. This is labor. This is work. They're learning on the job. So they're getting the soft skills. You know, how to wear PPE correctly. How to, you know, the safety aspects. How to take a break. How to report to a boss. How to take an evaluation and complete those things. All that's part of that program while they're working in. And this is not just highway cleanup. This is not just picking up trash. This is highway maintenance. This is clearing drainage. This is clearing trees, things that, you know, can cause their safety issues that the Department of Transportation has. This is a real contract with DOT to do those services. So they're learning all that. While they're doing that, they're getting earning a stipend to be paid. That stipend pays their court fees and restitution first. Okay, ask a JPO. Yes, more of that, right? Because that's the only thing that keeps them on probation sometimes. It's just the court fees and restitution. And if it wasn't for that, the judge would let them off probation, but they can't get that paid. So that program is highly successful in paying that off. Just in the last pre-COVID, pre-Michael, Hurricane Michael year, because that had a factor, there was over $80,000 just in Circuit 2 that was paid through that contract to be able to pay off court fees and restitution. Nothing touches that. Majority of the time you do car washes or whatever to try to pay off court fees and restitution. You know, that doesn't work. It's real work. The kids are putting in the work. The Department of Transportation is really happy with those contracts. The kids do the work, and they're getting paid to do that, and they're using that for a good cause. There's nothing like it. So those are the two programs that I wanted to mention that Donnie asked me to, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for your appreciation, your time and attention to the matters.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Very helpful.
Not only.
Yes, Representative Duggan. And then Representative, Vice Chairman Roth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understood you to say that it's $80,000. What's the total cost of the contract for the work, which I assume is basically a pilot? And what would it, in your opinion, cost to scale to the state?
You know, we scaled that at about, I think it was $250,000 to $300,000 per unit. And unit being a crew to you know, to have the equipment, hire the right people, all the safety equipment, all the, because they have to have small tools, hand tools.
Vans.
Yeah, the vans, you know, equipment, the trailers, to be able to carry that equipment. So it's about $250,000 to $300,000 per unit, and a unit's going to have one contract. That'd be a crew of five. With a crew of five with a team leader, meaning the crew with five would be the youth, and the team leader being the employed person to run that crew, and that would be for a full year.
And how many units statewide?
I don't think we've ever done the math on that, but you probably say about as many as there are counties. Some counties being bigger, and some counties being smaller, so you can have one crew for multiple counties. So, you know, I would estimate around 60 to 70 crews.
And one thing we failed to mention is that Maurice, not only did he pay off his court costs and his restitution, once he finished those costs, how much did you take? He had $1,000 in his pocket. And see, here's what a lot of people don't. So some of that money, it not only is it paying court costs restitution, but it's money for them to go, you know, the kid that I talked about was this tall and this wide, and 6'8", a few years later, you know, they grow. Some of them gain weight, you know, they're teenage boys, they're going to grow. And so they go into our program, when they come out a year later, they don't have clothes to fit when they go home. They, you know, they've got to buy wardrobe. They, you know, a lot of times their brothers and sisters have taken this or that, and they got to replace things. So that's money. You know, it can be a down payment for a vehicle. We've had a number of kids that have taken that money to put a down payment on a vehicle so they had transportation, which is one of the huge issues in their transition back. I want to – oh, I'm sorry. No, Representative had a question.
Vice Chair Roth, yes.
Yeah, I just had a simple question. I guess this is to Tony. Appreciate so much the explanation. To me, what I heard was just, you know, boots on the ground, common sense, you know, connecting A to B, this is what we need to do, and this is how we're going to get it done. Very simple, straightforward. So on the stipend, what percentage of their pay gets diverted to the restitution and court cost?
Until it's paid?
Until it's paid.
Yes, sir. It's paid.
So I know, but what percentage? They get part of their pay. So what percentage of their pay gets deducted? All of it?
All of it until, especially when they're in the residential program, they can't have money.
Okay.
So all that goes into, right, and then that's paid off. And then when that's paid off, then the money builds to give them a check when they leave. So in the residential.
We've had kids leave our program that had a GED when they came in that would leave with $4,000 or $5,000. Of course, we've had one or two. One kid decided he wanted to break into the collision center and steal cars and take them out in the woods in Bluntstown and burn them. And he had $40,000 in restitution. Well, we did the best we could with that one. But that was a way out. You know, most of our kids, well, Tony said it, 94% of our kids, when they leave residential, 94% of our kids have paid, have zero court costs and zero restitution. So, did that answer? Thank you. So I want to close real quickly. I know we're running out of time, but I could.
We got a few quick questions. Make them really quick. Because I tell you, we could be here all day and not get enough information. This will be not be the last you hear from us. We want to have a follow-up strategy. Let me go through the list. Ranking Member Valdez.
Thank you very much, Chair Altman. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the experience of the work. For instance, what is their stipend? How much do they get paid? How many hours do they work? And what kind of work do they do? What kind of training do they obtain? I mean, I'd imagine if they're in a highway, and what are their age groups?
Well, they're typically 14 to 18. Their stipends are $7.95, $8. Yeah, that's right. 45. They typically spend about 5 hours a day out on the work site. I'll give you an example. The reason this got started, the exit between Capitol Circle West and the Midway exit, 1 year there was 12 fatalities in that four-mile span, and guy called me up and said, we need some community service. We know you do it. Can your kids come out and do this? And so we went out there, and all we did was clean drains and replace the cover on those drains. But the kids are learning so much more than that. They're learning, you know, that work experience, clocking in, clocking all those kind of things. But you know, they've replaced signs, they weed eat, you know, they replace gutters. This whatever has to happen to keep the road safe. That led to, we did that project, it was supposed to take 6 months. We did it in less than three. He said, you want a contract? And I said, what are you talking about? He said, we'll pay those kids. And that's when we come up with the idea, well, instead of community service, we've got plenty of community service in these communities that we can do. Let's do that community service on the weekends, and let's have them, and they work typically 1 day a week for five, because they had to do their education classes, right, and vocation classes. So they got to get their hours in there. But so typically they're going once a week for 5 hours. We came up with a formula where they're paid that stipend, and it goes to court cost and restitution. The rest of it goes to the kid.
Rep Williams, and then Rep Woodson, and then Rep Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I work with a lot of youth, and I know as someone working and volunteering and mentoring youth, it's a burnout for the advocates that help, the foster parents that step in, the mentor that's willing to be there for the kids. Is it any type of special programs that you have to assist these people that's willing to give so much time back to the children?
You know, we experience that from time to time, but and I know this is going to sound really hokey, okay? So just bear with me. But we have created such a family atmosphere in Twin Oaks, from me to my brothers to our family down to our directors, you know, that our, I believe, and they could speak to this, but you know, I love these ladies like they're my daughters. I would start to say sisters, but I'm so much older than them, but like they're my daughters. You know, Jenny was our employee of the year last year. Incredible lady. You know, but when it's almost like, you know, I know we do experience that because I experience it from time to time, especially the first, what I didn't tell you was first 2.5 years that we opened the wilderness program, I lived on campus. So I was dealing with it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and you can burn out, but it's we're looking for that person that loves to work kids, that's family oriented, that will buy into our culture and our model. And just support them, And yes, we do face some burnout, but it makes it so much easier, so much better when you can when you have that kind of relationship.
Okay, Rep. Woodson. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again. This question is for the chairman. You reported that 92% of the kids did not recidivate. For the 8%, that and 92% is extremely high. I was a court counselor for one of the programs in Miami called ADAP. I don't know if you know of it, but it deals with troubled kids as well who got into the system. And 92% is excellent. But for the 8% that were not successful, was there any evaluation done to see what are some of the underlying issues that kept them from being successful?
Yes, ma'am. So very good question. Every youth that we serve, we have an evaluation process. Obviously, at the front end, an assessment's done to determine what services are needed, put those in place in the individualized service plan, update individualized service plan as we go along because priorities change, goals change. But when we, for every unsuccessful youth, then we do in a post-service evaluation, okay, what did we do? What could we do, you know, to better, to have the kid be successful? A lot of times, you know, you're dealing with kids, especially nowadays, with less youth being referred into residential services. Mm-hmm. The kids who are going into residential services are a higher end youth. You know, they're higher, offending youth. So you're talking about gang involvement is a high, it's a challenge that we have in the transition, right? Because as soon as that kid comes back to that street, and we're there, as the gentleman said over here, we're boots on the ground. Our program, we don't have offices. Mm-hmm. I expect my people to be on the street. I give them the resources. I give them the tools, the mobile tools to be able to use, to be able to provide. I want them in the homes. I want them in the street. I want to meet the kid where the kid's at. I don't want to meet them in a sanitized office where they know they're never going to be able to spend any time in, right? I want them on the street. So when we see that kid go back to the street, we see the gang members there, and we see that, you know, this is the challenge that we're going to have to deal with. We can't change where they're placed. That's a DCF, you know, DCF world. That's, you know, what they do. And certainly parents, you know, if they're, you know, with their parents. But, you know, overcoming those obstacles are the hard part, and a lot of times when we see that recidivism, it's generally because of some type of criminogenic behavior that's in that neighborhood, in that street level, that's hard to overcome, and it pulls them back into such a tough thing to fight.
Okay, we are
out of time. Thank you.
We're running out of time, so I'm going to encourage everyone to write down their questions. We're going to do a robo-question run here. We got three, maybe one more. Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. I had two, but I'm just going to make one. I wanted to talk about, you were saying the kids that are just on probation, they're not in the residential program, how they needed those core areas, the education, vocational training, and mentoring. Is there a program in place for them to get that now? And, you know, where are we on that thing?
Okay, so very good question. Back when former Secretary Christy Daley, now Brodeur, Christy Brodeur, was the Secretary of DJJ, Amendment number 6 to our contract added probation services we could provide services in the Project Connect program, not just with transition. Those are post-commitment probation or conditional release youth. They're true transition coming out of a residential program. But the second priority in the contract now is probation youth. Okay. So traditionally in a normal year, we serve 17 to 18% probation youth. Those are the youth before residential programming. So we serve a small population of those.
But you need,
as I kind of said before, we have 40 slots here total in Leon County, or in Circuit 2. About 5 of those are for probation because the priority is still the transition kids. So if we fill them with transition kids, we can't put probation in them. So that's the challenge, is we need to designate slots
for
probation, right, just for probation. Because if not, when you have a bump in transition kids, they're always going to fill their slots up. And then you won't have any for probation kids. There's some circuits that I don't have, you know, Circuit 4, Jacksonville, I have very few probation kids because they're all filled with transition, which is the first priority of the contract. I'm sorry, post-residential kids.
That are I understood. I was following.
Rep. Joseph? Rapid fire.
Rapid fire is, I don't know if the ladies you keep alluding to as your daughters are going to say anything to us, but if not, I wanted to just thank them for what they do and see if they wanted to add one sentence. If there's anything that they wanted us to know that wasn't already presented, I wanted to just offer up that opportunity.
That's an excellent, excellent idea. If they would like, they're front line. It might be helpful to hear from them. I like that.
So Nicole Miller, our education director for the agency.
I just wanted to thank all of you guys for being here today and listening to Marisa's story and supporting the agency who allows us to do this work for kids. I couldn't imagine being with another provider or doing anything else. I started the agency as an intern and have stayed here since because of their dedication to kids and the ability they give us to really forever touch the lives of the kids we serve. So thank you all so much. And thank you guys for giving us that opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you.
Someone asked a question about burnout and like how you...
I'm Jeannie O'Mell.
I'm the lead educator. So someone asked a question about burnout, and I've been with the agency for about 20 years now. Okay. And basically, there have been days when I felt like I just couldn't go on. And then I meet kids like Lewis, and basically, there is no burnout. You can't burn out. And so, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So okay, we've got Trabulski.
Thank you, Chair. Just call me Trouble. It's fine.
I always get the last.
It's okay.
Yeah, the last syllable there.
Thank you so much for your presentation this morning and sharing what you are doing with these youth and sharing your life with them. My question is just really simple. Do you have any youth that you've served over, you know, the past your time that have come back and served for you or mentor for you?
Glad you said that. I was going to bring him up as an example. We had a young man that left us, was really into our carpentry program and our horticulture and all that. And we do a hydroponics garden, fish on the bottom, lettuce on top or whatever, vegetables, feed the kids and that sort of thing. John left us. He was gone for, how long was he gone? 5 years? Yeah, so he came, after being gone for 5 years, he walked in my door in my office one day and said, I want to come work for you. And I said, you're kidding. I said, you do? And I said, you'd be great. And he is great. He's a great staff. He's been with us now about a year. And, you know, he's at the point that we have the opportunity to expand our aquaponics, he'll probably be the one to take that over, or he could take over the carpentry program. But he's really a gifted young man, did well.
Thank you, Rep. So I think we're back up. We got one more presentation. I wanted to personally thank you, and this we won't stop here. I mean, this is just the beginning. We want to follow up, get more information. Any other questions or directions?
Can I have 30 seconds to answer Representative Valdez's
question? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I told her I was going to come back to it. So one of the things we're working on now, have been working on for the last 3 years, you ask about the dually served kids, hard-to-place foster kids. We're creating Waypoint Technical College. It'll be the first technical college specifically for foster kids in the country. Foster kids have specific needs when they age out. 60% of those kids, when they age out within 2 years, are homeless, they're incarcerated, or they're deceased. That's a problem. I told you earlier that we are a solutions-oriented company. When that came to my attention, I told our leadership team, we've got to solve this issue. So we're creating Waypoint Technical College. It's going to be a different model than anybody's ever seen. We've put about $5 million into two manufacturing plants so that these kids can come live with us. They can be educated, get vocational training. They can go to work in manufacturing plants, multiple industry certifications. Then we'll transition to the community that of their choosing through Project Connect to place them and make sure that they're successful. Because as a state and as a human being, we cannot let those numbers continue.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And Maurice, thank you. You're a talented young man. I don't know, I've been doing this a long time. I don't think I've seen anyone touch a committee more than you have today. You're gifted. Thank you for who you are and what you've accomplished.
And we do want to be a resource.
Yes. So contact.
I'll leave a stack of cards right here. Yes. Just grab them.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, we're going to follow up. And our two speakers that we didn't have on, we need you to fill out a speaker card. The sergeant can get you one. Thank you so much. It was very, very inspirational and looking forward to following up.
Chair Altman?
Yes.
I wonder if there could be an opportunity for maybe to go as a committee, maybe and tour the facility, see what it's like.
I think it's a great idea.
I would love to do that and get, have an opportunity to talk to the youth as well and just get a feel for it.
We'll look into that. Amazing. We haven't done that yet. Yeah. So we need to just get one in. So that'd be good.
Okay.
Can't think of a better one. Okay, great. Let's move on to our next.
Thank you. You are such a blessing. I just wish you well. Do well.
Where's Maurice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Come here, Maurice.
Yeah. Okay. Our next speaker, we'd like to recognize Faye Johnson, CEO of Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition, to discuss their Fatherhood Pride initiatives.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And I know it's been, how do you follow that? I don't know, but I was just so full over there. But I can say one day, maybe, Maurice would be a father.
Yes.
And so we have to understand it's important to recognize how important fathers are in the building of their children and where they are in the status of our families. Mm-hmm. So having said that, my name is Faye Johnson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition, located in Jacksonville, Florida. We cover 5 counties in the Northeast Florida area in many of our programs. So I hope I have the right. Kathy's not here to guide me. Did it. So good morning again. We are one of 33 coalitions in the state of Florida. We fall under the Florida Association of Healthy Start Coalitions. There are 32 of us, and we are located in Northeast Florida. Coalitions across the state lead the community in developing systems of care that impact infant mortality in a positive way. So we work with our moms, our babies, our newborns all over the state of Florida. And like I said, we're just one of many coalitions doing this type of work across the state. And our Fatherhood Pride program that I'm going to talk with you a little bit about, and when I think about the young men, I just can't get them out of my mind. I think about prevention and how important it is to, if we could, on the front end, prevent our children from going into the system through a family system of care. And that's what we need to understand. It's very important, as he mentioned, he didn't know who his father was. So our goal is, in Northeast Florida with our program, is to strengthen our families. We have 3 key areas that we focus on in our service delivery: strengthening families, saving babies, and building communities. So those are 3 areas. Our fatherhood program falls under our strengthening families program to build self-sufficiency in fathers and to get them to understand the importance of co-parenting. For one thing, because just because you're not with the mom does not mean you can't be a parent, a co-parent. But you also, as a father, have to understand, and this is what our classes teach, you need to be ready, responsible, to lead healthy and safe families. And that's very important in the work that we do. Saving fathers, serving fathers. We started serving fathers back in 2006, where there was absolutely no funding. Still, funding is limited for fatherhood programs. Most of the funding is for maternal and child health programs around mothers and babies. But that doesn't stop us from trying to continuously fill the gap with our fatherhood program. We started in 2006 with the Responsible Fatherhood Program, and we're continuing to this day. Funding has come and gone, but we continue. We're not able to serve all 5 counties right now, but we're serving Duval County mainly with our fatherhood program as we move forward. Our Fatherhood Pride Program is parental responsibility, and we take that very seriously in our program. I am not the director. Now, if I stood here and said I was the director of the program, he would probably, I don't know what he would do, but he does not let me off the hook in understanding that you can talk about mothers and babies all day long, but until you address the fathers, you haven't reached the entire family. So I am how should I say, devoted and everything to making sure that our fathers are included in our whole service delivery model. So the Fatherhood Pride program, like I said, is parental responsibility inspiring dads everywhere. Doesn't matter whether you're incarcerated, you're out, you're working, we want all fathers to come and be a part of this model. So who we serve, community fathers, father figures and their families in Duval County, that is our current focus area, has been for, since I said, 2006. We have courses that we teach pre-COVID, and as you can see, this is definitely a pre-COVID picture because there are no masks or anything, and we were meeting face-to-face. Now most of our courses are done virtually, and that's a little challenging for us because men, you know, you all get together. You say you don't get together, but then when you do get together and start talking, you all can talk. So they like to be in person opposed to the virtual, but we're doing some interesting things to try to still bring them together. So understanding dads is one of the main important roles that we try to make sure that we work with our fathers and understanding that we understand their challenges in our community. We understand that there are needs of dads just like there are mothers. We understand that, you know, the criminal justice system and those type of things and substance abuse and those type of things have impacted your life. However, we also want to make sure that we understand those challenges, but help them to work through those challenges so they can have healthy, safe relationships with their children. That's the main thing. In doing that, the services we provide is case management services to help them navigate the various systems, whether they're court systems. Child support was a big issue that was a barrier for a lot of our dads, seeing why they did not interact with their moms because the moms wouldn't let them see the children because they owed child support payments and those type of things. So our fatherhood program really worked with the child support division and the fathers to get them in a better situation where they could pay up their arrearage and things like that without losing their license and have the relationships with their children that they needed to have. Our group classes consist of boot camp for new dads. That's a class for new fathers, newborn babies, first time around, and they get to do all the swaddling and the diaper changing and all those kinds of things, but more importantly, skin to skin and bonding with that newborn baby. That's very important in dads understanding their place with skin to skin contact. Our safe sleep and safe sleep, as you all know, is one of the major leading causes of infant mortality. When we place babies in the bed, sometimes that can cause a baby not to live an accident, or when we place the baby in a crib with a lot of fluffy blankets and all those kinds of things. But also we want our dads to understand that when you place that little newborn face down on your chest and you go to sleep in a reclining chair, some things could happen with that baby not being able to survive that experience. So dads are taught that and what not to do with their children as it relates to safe sleep. Our 24/7 dads class also is a course that teaches responsibilities of fathers. It's particularly, this is a course that dives into the relationship with their teenage sons and the responsibility and what they tell them and working with them. And then we also have some teen dads that go through the 24/7 dads class as well. And it's very important to catch those young men right then, early on rather than later. Co-parenting workshops, that's where we teach our dads to be able to work with the mom, even though you may not be married to her, you may not be together. Don't just say, I'm not going to see my child because I don't get along with mom. That's unacceptable. Let's work this out and see how you can co-parent. Additional activities, these were pre-COVID, like I said. We do a lot of activities with our fathers and the children. Fishing events, they go on, all kind of different activities. They have barbecues. We had a Barbers for Babies type event where the guys, these are the teens mostly and their sons, played football games against each other, and we gave out, you know, medals. And the dads and the guys, it was just such a bonding experience for them. So these are some of the things we do to ensure bonding. Additional activities, male responsibility, are training our targeted teens. Like I said, we do have some teens that are fathers. So we want to work with them now and to prevent them, you know, not prevent, I should say, but encourage them to wait until they finish high school, go on to school, finish some of those things because they become a second-time father. So those are the things that we work with. These are some of our events that we've had in the past in serving our dads, our Fatherhood Pride program, and ensuring that they know their place and responsibility in healthy relationships. Some of the program impact that we talk about, these are some of the quotes that we have from some of our fathers. So many fathers feel hopeless out there. The program has given me hope. That was one that really stood out to me because we see that in the discussions that they feel sometimes, you know, the moms and the babies get all the attention and they're just sort of, you know, there. But they're very important. We want to make sure of that. So when we talk about the impact of the program from 2015 to 2020, 100% of the participants reported being helped, 78% some, and then the others were a lot. 57% of the community fathers and 91% of the incarcerated fathers had jobs at the program completion compared to the 28%. 76% of the dads enrolled in the program to be better at being a father. So they felt they were now better at being fathers. So also the program, as you look at, the last one to me stands out. 894 participants completed all program requirements. And if you want to know what that number was, it was 1,247 that were enrolled in the program. Of that, 894 completed. You can see some of the investment on the return of investment, improved health for the children, being able to medical cost, and those type of things also were some of the return on investment. And just having a vested interest in being a father and supporting their children were very important to them. Lessons and recommendations that we've learned, we continue to learn, because we're not done yet. We have a long way to go. The men face a myriad of issues, like I said, lack of resources to handle employment, health concerns like a family support, substance use is a big barrier for many of our dads. Many are in recovery and making it through housing concerns and recidivism rates themselves as it relates to incarceration. So this is some of our lessons. And also workforce development, job-driven employment services should be a priority for our dads when they're trying to re-engage back into the system. Because men and dads, they like to feel that they're contributing something to the family. A lot of them stay away because they don't feel like they have anything to contribute. And so in order for them to do that, they need to be able to work. They need to be able to go back to school and those type of things. Building a referral system to ensure community partners understand the services so they can connect dads. And it's limited services for fatherhood programs, but we are finding that the more we get the information out there, the more people know and the better the services are for our fathers. So I thank you all very much. I tried not to speak too much, but I know it's been a long day already this morning, but we believe at Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition, every baby, every day. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Wonderful presentation. Wonderful slides, to the point, informative. I know we'll have some questions. Yes, Representative Robinson.
My question was simply, you said you had 1,000 dads or a little over 1,000 dads that participated in the program. How did you all, you know, get them? How were they introduced to the program? And
well, there are different ways of the referral source. The court system, for one, they came to us through the court system. The other was that we have within our coalitions a cadre of home visitation programs. So our home visitation programs, which are for newborn babies and pregnant moms primarily, refer fathers into the program as well. And also community referrals the same way.
Rep. Whitson, then Rep. Bartleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation as well. What other organizations do you partner with in order to leverage your resources for your dads, for the dads that you serve?
Sure. And
I know resources are kind of scarce, especially when you're trying to help fathers. So do you partner with any other organization, or how do you leverage your resources?
We leverage our resources by partnering with a lot of organizations, because you're correct. The funding is limited. From 2015 to 2020, we actually had a really nice grant that we had at that time. But as you know, funding comes and funding goes away. But in Jacksonville, we partnered with the various, such as Operation New Hope and some of the other programs that are in Jacksonville for resources, career source for jobs. Some of the programs that have funding also have placement specialists. So we leverage our resources by working with them to help get some of our dads placed in some of these positions. And they also know the employers that hire ex-offenders. So we try to make sure we're keyed in with them as well. Child Support Department of Revenue we partner with and work toward the arrearage that they have as far as child support to see if they complete the courses. If they go through and complete the courses, the guys keep their license so they can go to work? So that's one of the things that we've embedded in there. So there are quite a few organizations that we have to, you know, partner with them because the funding is limited on what we can do. We have currently now 4 case managers, I believe, serving them.
Thank you. Representative Barlin.
Thank you.
I have a question about, are you keeping any data on the children as well? And longitudinally, will you look to see how they do with the support that you're providing?
Sure.
I know you're kind of in your infancy, but,
yeah.
And they have to grow up, but I'm just curious, are you collecting any data?
We haven't collected data long-term on the children. The data that I would have currently will be on children, but more so the infants, the babies, because that's what we're tracking mostly in our infant side, but not long-term as it relates to the teens of the dads, and I mean, teens of the fathers that we enroll. So that's something I'll have to take a look at.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Appreciate you letting me speak.
No problem. Thank you. Representative Duggan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi.
Welcome to the Florida House.
Thank you.
Couple questions, if I may, just a couple compound questions. First of all, is the program a continuum, and is there an end point at which the fathers are like, they have to leave or they're done, or can they continue to participate in the activities? You know, there's a different skill set with having a second or third child, as an example, they might benefit. And secondly, what does the funding pay for, and what would additional funding help expand?
The program is continuum. They can complete all of the courses that they have, and they complete all their classes and everything, but they can always come back, always, and just stay and continue on, and they can become mentors. And we have had that happen with some of the dads that completed, and they wanted to mentor some of the other dads that were in the program. So, yes, they can come back. It's not like one time and you're done. They just get a certificate for completion of all the courses that they take, though. So that was the first question. Second question, currently, right now, like I said, we're covering Duval County only. In the past, we were able to provide services in all five counties that the Northeast Florida Healthy Starts Coalition provides. And so currently in Duval County, we have four case managers, and I'll just give you an example. When we were covering all counties, we had about seven case managers. To the tune, and that particular grant was around about $500,000, $600,000 a year for 5 years. Now we have our funding from a foundation which covers Duval County, and it's averaging about $200,000 a year.
I have a question. Are there any other programs similar to this under the Healthy Start umbrella throughout the state that you're aware of?
I don't want to speak for the other Healthy Start coalitions. I know that some may have a fatherhood, but not in depth, but I don't want to speak for the others. So if I could get that information and send that back to the committee, I would appreciate it.
That'd be interesting, and I think it's... you've done a wonderful job. Fascinating. And I know we had All-Pro Dad, our last meeting, with a similar mission. I don't know if you've partnered with them on any of your activities or not.
Not a detail, but I know of them. I do know of them. I do.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That was very, very helpful. Oh, Representative, Ranking Member Valdez.
Thank you, Chair Altman. This question, I promise, is not a trap. But it's just a thought that comes in. In your experience, do you believe or do you find it beneficial as a punishment for driver's licenses to be suspended or revoked if a father is behind on their child support?
So... I will say that in serving our dads, how can he go to work if he doesn't have a license, driver's license? How can he really see his child if he's co-parenting? If he does not go to work, he can't survive and take care of his family. Now, can he get bus tickets or some of those things without a license? But he has to work in order to buy bus tickets. There's a cycle that you have to understand when policies and things are in place, such as that. So did I answer your question?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
She has a follow-up.
I have a follow-up question. Sure. Do you think that the process of garnishing wages would be a better solution, and maybe not garnishing all wages, because I guess they have to live as well.
They have to live as well. Is there an incentive to then maybe not have your wages garnished, so you do the things that you need to do in order for your wages not to be garnished? But if your wages are garnished, again, how are you going to pay your bills, pay your restitution, pay those things, and not end back up on probation or some of those things or in jail because you weren't able to pay your restitution?
One quick follow-up.
Yes.
What do you suggest be a solution to that problem?
Just simple questions.
Sure, that's fine. No. I think, and we've talked about this, and actually in Northeast Florida, this is one thing that we have put in our 10-point plan, 5-point plan around infant mortality. I do think it's important to look at some of the policies that are driving this and examine some of the policies such as you're speaking of. That's what I really think needs to happen. Could I stand here and say, well, you need to do this, you need to do that? I really think a close examination of the policy around these two issues that you've raised would provide you the answer that you're looking for.
Thank you. Chair Altman, I just believe that as we're talking about fatherlessness in our children's lives, I wonder what some of those barriers are. I can't believe that people just want to abandon their children. I just can't believe that in my core. And I believe that sometimes it's just some of these challenges, generational poverty, trying to get out of a bad situation in a neighborhood and you can't, and those kinds of things perpetuate. So I wonder as policymakers and lawmakers, what are the policies that we should really be looking at to try and support what we're trying to do here and increase or decrease the fatherlessness in our children's lives and hopefully trying to bring back that family unit?
Well, I think those are all really good questions, and your response is spot on. These decisions, these very difficult decisions, most of which I know Rep. Duggan probably would be able to answer better than me, being a lawyer, are made in our juvenile court. And so we in our committee are so intricately tied to what happens in our criminal justice system, but this is not just a criminal justice issue. These are human beings, and I think if we were to look at them, I think we've got to look into our court. I mean, we've got to support our judges. We need to give them flexibility. We need to provide adequate support. And we had a lot of debate last year regarding him and lied him and how we provide legal representation to children. I think it gets core to those. And we got to have really good judges. You know, we got to get good people on the bench. Mm-hmm. Representative Roth, Vice Chair Roth. So that's a direction I think we need to look at, too. It's a tough issue. Because we can't sit here in Tallahassee and make laws to solve all these individuals. There's got to be a forum, an area, through our court system and through our to address these very difficult.
Understood.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for making me think. So I have a comment to make as we're closing today. So many times I tell people, because people come to us all the time and ask for appropriation requests, we need more dollars because we're having children in our communities that are on drugs, and we need this and we need that. And I always go to the same comment, and I want to compliment you for what you're doing, because we cannot solve all the problems in the world on the back end by more money. I always say to people, okay, let's put some more dollars towards this, but you as a community leader need to be reminding people all the time that if we do not have fathers and mothers working together to raise their children and having stronger families, we're never going to get a hold of this. So God bless you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
We're backed up against our notice deadline. Thank you. And we've got a lot of food for thought and a lot of direction, a lot of work ahead of us. So I want to thank you for taking the time to come over and talk to us. It's a great honor having you. You have a big job over there, and Northeast Florida. So thank you for what you do. And with that, Representative Bartle, with that, members, this concludes the agenda for today. And Representative Bartleman moves, we rise without objection. She is rising. Upon the motion of Representative Bartleman, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.